Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back to the Angus Table podcast. This is my interview with Tim Ford from Feed Central and Local Ag. Tim and I actually went to college together back in the early 90s. Tim studied agribusiness at Gatton College while I was studying rural management. Tim launched Feed Central in 2002, specialising in the marketing, trading of fodder, and also the quality assurance of hay in a laboratory. He's done very well in business. He knows a lot of people. He's probably traded hay with a lot of our members. So we pick up this conversation with Tim telling us a little bit more about the local ag marketplace.
So somebody can come into the local ag marketplace these days and deal direct with a buyer, or deal, buyers themselves can deal direct, or they can be fully supported by our team, essentially whichever they choose.
Okay. And sort of geographic reach, Tim, where do you operate?
Very much on the East Coast. We've done business in Western Australia and Northern Territory on and off over the period of time, and most recently during autumn this year, we did quite a bit of business out of Northern Territory and Western Australia into Victoria, but predominantly East Coast, so Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, and South Australia. Those states have all been very, very good to us. Lots and lots of buyers and sellers through those states, and some years or most years, Victoria has traditionally been a supply state. This year, Victoria has been a very big. Last couple of years, Victoria has been a very big buyer state, end user state. So across that East Coast, as seasons come, seasons change, people come into the system, go out of the system, re-enter a couple of years later. It's a pretty vibrant sort of a market, across that East Coast.
It's certainly been very hard in the south, hasn't it, the last two seasons, I guess.
Yeah, they've had a couple of really tough seasons, and that's put a lot of pressure on the feed chain, that's for sure.
Yeah, I was in Victoria last week and they're very nervous, I guess, about the rest of spring this year. I remember 2002 was a drought year. It was, and you would have just been not long into the business. What did that do for your business at the time? Was that a real lever that enabled you to grow at that particular time? Was it difficult? How did that set you up?
2002 was sort of the beginning, or around the beginning of that millennial drought, I suppose, wasn't it?
Yep,
the millennial drought, and then there was a couple of okay years, and then 07, 08, 09 were particularly dry again. We did get started during that 02 drought. Look, there is no doubt that droughts are good for fodder business. It's when the demand is high, and also our supply does increase because we have a lot of frosted crops and so forth. I suppose that was a really important point in giving us a national reach, at least off the east, across the East Coast. And our family connections really kicked in during that period with people in the Riverina supplying us. Between mum and dad in particular have very strong, dad's passed away and mum's very elderly now, but their family's very strong connections through the Riverina and Northern Victoria. So in those days, I could make any phone call and get supply, which was really, really, really important to us. So we really went with that Southern state supply during that period of time, and then built, and then through South Australia as well. And a lot of those clients are still with us today. They're not necessarily in the business every year, but they're certainly, the names keep popping up year in, year out. Those family names that we and those people and those characters we did business with in those days, they're constantly ringing up and many of them are, you're still doing business with, which is pretty, pretty good.
That is good. I guess in that early stage, you would have started, you probably had a notebook and a phone and a laptop, and What's it grown to today, Tim? What's your business in terms of people? And
yeah, in the early days, it was me, and then it was sort of me and one other fella, Ash, and then mum and dad would jump in the ute and do a whole lot of inspections for us on a voluntary basis. It was their sort of retirement plan, I suppose, to help. Just they couldn't really help financially, but it was their retirement plan to help the kids. And so they hopped in the ute and they got to see a bit of the country and do a whole heap of hay inspections. And they, you know, they'd catch up with a whole heap of friends all around the country that they'd met through their lifetime. And so there was that real small team. Today, you know, and then we'd had the likes of Glyke contracting and doing transport for us. Today, you know, the Glyke contracting team are still doing transport for us, but also we've got, there's probably on most days of the week there'd be 40 people doing something in our business. So there's 20, 21 full or staff team members, and there's a team of rover inspectors that work part-time doing inspections across the country, and then there's truck drivers, computer coders, you know, accountants and et cetera. You know, there'd be a team of, you know, between 30 and 40 people doing something on any given day of the week within our business, Scott. So
that's significant, isn't it? That's a lot of people to manage, a lot of moving parts.
There's a lot of moving parts. So, there's a lot of moving parts. We've got a great team. They don't take a lot of management. It's just a lot of moving parts, and keeping communication going through the team is a really important part of it.
I imagine it is. As you grew, and look, a lot of our listeners are members. We've got 4,000 members at Angus Australia. They're cattle producing people. They've got businesses and they're growing businesses. What are some of the lessons you learned along the way in terms of growing that team of people?
Yeah, the number one is people, and it just seems so obvious. But when you drop the ball on that, you really really suffer. And for us, people is the team, and people is the clients. And so staying connected to people and bringing people along on the journey is really important. You know, on the team front, there's a whole heap of examples of, you know, where you think you've done really well, and there's a whole heap of examples of where you haven't done things so well. And I think that's the same with any business owner, particularly when you're learning along the way. And you know, some people you probably didn't exit fast enough, and some people you wish like hell they were still here.
Yeah.
And you know, at the end of the day, the people management side is a gigantic piece, and so many businesses sort of don't get from that one or two team members to that just because of the piece around people, and so. You know, being able to acquire that skill or that technique is a really, really big part of growing a business. And then be able to manage that without keep in front of clients. You know, like I'd like to be spending more time with clients right now. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of growth, a lot of development with local ag, and I feel a real urge to get back in front of clients, you know, really strongly right now. And so we've sort of got to have that team shaped, and it just takes time, and you go through those periods when you can, and you know, it's just like, you know, just letting go with the flow a bit and trying to direct the traffic so that you can be where I need to be at the right time as well.
Okay. In terms of proportion, Tim, what proportion would be our members often think about fodder and drought circumstances or dry seasons, and then you've got those parts of the fodder industry that are have continual supply needs all the time, like your feedlots on the other extreme. What sort of proportion would be looking after or drought or seasonal deficit areas as opposed to constant supply or export?
We love the constant supply people, and the constant supply people are often those feedlots, and there's a lot of backgrounders out there as well. I reckon if we went through our database and went through your database, there'd be a handful of clients that are buying off us every year that are probably pretty strong Angus people, and they'd be backgrounders, you know, handling stock and wanting to supplementary feed around weaning and those sort of things. We're seeing an increase in the use of hay around weaning, around getting cattle ready for a feedlot situation, those sort of things. And So you'd probably see a way to answer that question. You'd probably see the business almost double during a drought time. Okay. So the volume of the volume of trade that we do would almost double during a drought time. Now, there could be 3 or 4 months in, say the drought was 12 months, there could be 3 or 4 months that are particularly intense with supply, and then the rest of it could be a bit more spread out. But over the course of a year, you'd probably see the business double during a drought time, which brings a lot of challenges because you've got to be able to, you know, answer the phone, keep the trucks rolling, keep the people, you know, people burn out really quickly under those really stressful situations. So there's a lot of challenges around that as well.
Well, I can imagine you'd have cash flow challenges. How do you scale up that quickly?
Yeah.
How do you get the people you need to get the job done? It'd be, I guess, very challenging.
Yeah, and you, particularly because you really feel the need to help people out. You know, wait, yes, you can make a few dollars along the way, but you do get drawn into that sense of urgency, the sense of the critical nature of the industry. And so you feel really drawn to the necessity to help people and to get that product delivered on time, get the quality right. And, you know, the customers are under stress with drought and everything else. The last thing you want to do is for the wrong load to get delivered to the wrong person. Or for something to go wrong. So you do really not just have to gear up to be able to get the volume through, but to be the critical nature of what you're dealing with. You know, there's often bushfires associated with it. There could be a really bad frost that's affected grain yields, and to be able to gear up and the people operating and making decisions in a really stressful environment. So you have to be able to gear up and come to terms with that responsibility in the industry. And you feel obligated to do the right thing, and you have the personal responsibility to get it right for your clients, you know, under those tough environments.
Well, I imagine that's the case. I can remember one of our members calling me, and they were in that tough environment, and they were a victim of fraud because, you know, during challenging times where you've got to get food, you've got all sorts of cowboys and people taking advantage of other people as well. Tim, has that helped you set your business apart in terms of that credibility over a long period of time? Do you get people coming to you because they trust that you'll get the job done?
Yeah, look, it's definitely helped us differentiate ourselves and set ourselves apart by being professional and doing everything right. It is an unfortunate part of our industry, particularly during those drought times, that some some unscrupulous operators do pop their heads up. And sometimes those people are rare. On some occasions, those people are intentionally doing the wrong thing. But quite often, those people have, you know, I remember probably 2007. We'd been in the game for quite a while at that period of time, and there was a used car salesman at Dubbo who business must have been bad in the car sales, so he decided he was going to trade hay. Now, you know, and there was all these rumours going around how he wasn't delivering and the product wasn't right. He was letting all these people down. So then they were ringing us urgently because they were absolutely desperate for hay. Anyway, found his phone number back in those days. He looked in the land he looked in the land, and I found his phone number and his advertising. And I rang him up and just asked him what was going on. And he was probably a nice enough bloke, but he just didn't have the systems and the processes to cope. So he wasn't intentionally trying to rip people off. Like, he was wanting to do the right thing, but he just didn't have the systems to cope. So there's all of that happens in our industry during those times. And so we differentiate ourselves based on that. You know, we differentiate ourselves based on the quality assurance. We differentiate ourselves based on the fact that we put contracts in place.
Yes.
The new Local Ag platform has a really safe, secure payment system that allows people to manage all of that themselves if they choose to. And so, you know, all of those things, it is an industry where we can differentiate ourselves and we can lead in those spaces. So, yeah. which is a commercial benefit to us, I suppose. Yeah. And it also allows us to sort of set that standard in the industry, which is something that's really important to me. Like, I do see our role as setting a standard in the industry, and if others come in and try and follow and try and copy, then that's good, because that's lifting the whole standard across the industry, which is sort of a really important part of our role. And you know, let's hope, you know, the standard keeps increasing, because it is increasing. So
Yeah, you know. I think that's a credit to your reputation in the industry that people do see that, and that's probably why they gravitate to you. Tim, on a personal level, obviously you're dealing with pretty stressed people during that period of time, but we have the same conversations when our producers are going through hardship. How do you go on a personal level? You know, a lot of these people that are hurting at times, they've been long-term clients. How do you and your staff handle that pressure as well with those drought conditions?
Yeah, I suppose myself personally, I dig into the reasons why I'm here doing what I do. And, you know, I made a choice a couple of decades ago now not to be a farmer. So at a really, I cope by saying that was, I've made the decision where I am. And so, and the people that have decided to stay on the land, they've made those decisions. So that's a decision that's been made. I feel, I also say, well, my role is to help these people, and my role is to run a team that can help distribute fodder across the country during these really critical times. You know, my role is to keep that. So I've developed the ability, I suppose, to keep myself separate. I think I do a reasonable job at that. But the team, not all the team members have. I mean, they're listening to the stories over the phone. We do get stories of people having really deep conversations with our team members during those times, and you do get experiences where people, you know, lead you to believe that something really bad's going to happen, and that all happens across our phones and during those times. And so we do have training in place these days for our team members on how to handle that, what to do with those phone calls, and how to handle that personally. We have EAP Pro. I need to be there to help the team members for that. So I try and keep my day. I won't sort of answer the phone during those times, like, because my job really needs to be to help the team. If we can't help the team, we can't help the clients. So be really present for the team, be available for the team, have a group of managers within the business that are the same. And then have training as to what to do with those particular types of phone calls to help those people, and then have training so that our team members can cope with those conversations, and then follow up. We have an employee assistance program, and that's the really hard stuff. You don't get that stuff right, and you know, men, you know, don't think they need help, but then 3 months later something happens and they really did need the help. So there's lots and lots and lots in that space. It's a really big issue.
It certainly is, and we've been involved on the other end with cattle producers. Yeah, it's a difficult one, and yeah. Imagine that you'd come face to face with that quarter.
Yeah, particularly during those tough times, you'd come face to face with it really quick, and you know, you got to remember a good salesman's a good people person.
Yes.
In ag. So they're going to attract those conversations. And we got to, you know, we've got people that really want to look after people, so they attract those conversations. And I've probably personally developed some toughness or some resilience around that. Hopefully, I might be just sound like a typical man. Like a typical man now that doesn't need the help. But you know, it's a really important thing across the team.
Yeah, I could imagine. And it's just a factor of your industry that keeps going. Now on that drought, our guys are often cow-calf operators. They can be seed stock or commercial. Tim, is it right you're on the National Drought Task Force, or you've been?
Not at the moment. I have been on the National. Malcolm Turnbull and Barnaby Joyce put together the National Drought Task Force when they were Prime Minister and Deputy, and that went on for some time under the chairmanship of Major General Stephen Day, and we were certainly involved in that. Yeah, it's great to be able to contribute when those things at those times. So.
What did you learn from that, Tim? And in terms of if you've got a cattle producer listening to this podcast, what are some of the learnings that you would share with a beef producer in terms of drought preparedness?
There's a lot of stuff being spoken about this, and there's like lots and lots of money going towards it. I'm not sure whether that money's all going to be really well spent or not, but we're not here to talk about that. So it is a topic of conversation at the moment, isn't it? I'm not sure that the conversation of cash reserves is coming up. Like, It's great to have a huge reserve of fodder in your shed, obviously. It's great to have, a paddock locked away, especially. It's really good to have your containment paddock identified and, your sacrifice paddock identified so you can feed animals. That's been a real improvement over the last 10 years in particular, so that, people are having that sacrifice paddock. But I suppose a lot of people have already spoken about those things, and there's a lot of information out there around that. Some of the people, and I know it's a really privileged position that people could actually have cash in the bank to be able to survive these things. It's the same. At the end of the day, a drought fund. We have to have money tucked away for the really good seasons when our business is not burning. And it's the same. I think cash at bank gives a lot of flexibility. Because you can have this huge hay shed and you have all your infrastructure set up for drought feeding, and they're all really good tips. But you don't know what the market's going to do at the day. And so, if the cattle market happens, and it sometimes is, and the opportunity is there to sell cattle, for opportunities to hold cattle. And I think that's just, having $100,000 or $150,000 just tucked away for a drought fund within a family business. And a couple of people have spoken to me about that, and that is strictly what it's there for. Because that also brings the second point, where it's the realization that it's going to happen. And I think a lot of people struggle with the realization it's going to happen. A lot of people ring our office saying, this was so unexpected. We didn't expect this. This is the worst ever. Like, who would have thought? Well, I mean, the fact of life is that we live in Australia and droughts do come. And there can be regions in Australia that don't have a drought for 20 years. There's a lot of regions that have a drought, have 2 or 3 years every 10 years that are a really bad drought. But there's some regions that don't experience drought for maybe a generation or half a generation, don't experience drought. But the reality is it's going to come. So it's mindset. So, my contribution to this discussion is cash at bank, which I do understand is a really privileged position to be in. But the second contribution is a mindset that it is going to happen. And with the mindset that it's going to happen becomes that ability then to manage it. And if the first half of the drought, you're stuck in the mindset, why did this happen to me? And I'm a victim here. Then you're not going to be able to manage that. You're not going to be able to manage that drought. So finding that space in your life to develop that mindset that the drought is inevitable. Bad things can happen in business, and this is one thing we're going to have to prepare for. And so with mindset comes skill set around, decision-making in tough times, conversations, coping through tough times. And there's lots and lots of training out there about that. And I've done a lot of that training, and it really does help. But it can be difficult for people who are, stuck in a generational business, might not have had that upbringing where training and thinking and strategic thinking and communication and tough decision-making training, those sorts of things probably don't come naturally to most Australian families to sit down and have that training with somebody. But so with mindset, it then leads to preparation, and that's all around that mental preparation to coping during those really tough times.
Yeah, it's a really good point you raised, Tim. Is the biggest mistake you see going into drought that mindset and that preparedness?
I think we get the reality is we're in Australia and we shouldn't think that drought's not going to happen. And there's a lot of people out there that have the victim mentality, and they'll spend the first half or the whole of the drought being that victim.
Yes.
And when you're the victim of a drought, you can't be the manager of a drought. There'll be an opportunity there somewhere. I know it's really hard. There'll be an opportunity there somewhere. And so you cannot be the manager of a drought when you're the victim of the drought. It's almost impossible.
Yeah, it's a good... So
that's mindset.
Very good comment to make. Tim, in terms of fodder as a commodity, like all other commodities, yeah. So you would see huge fluctuations, I guess, in price over... So if we look at our careers, that 25 years or so that
you would like your maths.
Yeah. To be longer than that, actually. But since you've started, I guess you would have saw really big fluctuations, wouldn't you, from year to year at times. What sort of is the magnitude that you've seen in your time in the game?
Yeah, I suppose just on the prices vary dramatically, and you got the freight price as well. Yes. Like you got the hay prices, the commodity that the product you're buying, and then you got the delivery cost. And I mean, you know, it always amazes me that, you know, like hay could be $200 a ton in South Australia, and that grower has been growing it holding it, preparing for it, let's say 18 months, you know, but a minimum of 6 months. But he's been that preparing the paddock and everything could easily be an 18-month exercise to grow that hay, and that's $200 a ton. And then the freight's $200 a ton. So all of a sudden it's $400 a ton. So, you know, you've got this huge freight component to hay as well, and both need to add up. You know, like I think we're going to see, you know, future droughts, we've got this huge price variation happening. The country is only getting more intensive livestock production. We're not getting less intensive livestock production. And so, you'll often see hay double, even triple in price during those drought periods. So this most recent one, for example, in Victoria, South Australia, you probably saw hay, you know, Arden hay, cereal hay, for example, go from, you know, $200, $220 a ton back in January, and it was almost impossible to sell. By March, April, it was $300 a ton. By May, it was $500 a ton. So
it's a huge
fluctuation. Yeah, and then you know, the good thing about a rising price is it'll open up that eventually opened up supply from Western Australia. So that put a cap on price for a period of time, and then some rain came and the price fell back down again. But I don't think you're gonna see that open hay price go back to $200 a ton either. So, you know, it sort of goes up and it might come back. Might go up by $100, come back by $50, but it doesn't seem to go back by $100. So
Yeah, I imagine even let alone the producer, but for your management of that, it's very challenging, isn't it, from a business point of view?
Oh, yeah.
You're very exposed as well, aren't you, in terms of being able to get a hold of that amount of capital to fulfill orders that you need to. So it's a challenge right through the chain.
Yeah, it's a challenge right through the chain. And then you've got, logistics become a massive challenge during those times as well, just to be able to move the volume of hay that need to be moved in those drought periods, and just the number of trucks you can throw at it becomes, and then you'll see a movement in the freight because everything works off supply and demand. So you see the price of hay goes up and then freight gets squeezed. Even the freight, you know, the first few loads that you come back from Western Australia, you can get back for $150 a ton from Western Australia because you'll be picking up. But then to bring volumes back from Western Australia, and as soon as those guys realise that there's this volume business coming back, so they'll put the price up. You know, you're almost paying full rates to get back from Western Australia, you know, so you'll be paying $300 or $400 a ton freight. So you've got the supply and demand. There's two markets, supply and demand of hay and supply and demand of freight. And yes, they sort of work, they both work during those times. So
very tricky.
Yeah.
Tim, managing all the complexity, the staff, the seasonal fluctuations, What, from your perspective, what's the biggest mistake you've made or pitfall that you've found as an operator of that business? When you look back, what's one of the big learnings for you over that period of time?
I think making things too complex, you're trying to push the boundaries with tech all the time. Like, we do need to scale up, and the ability to scale. So you do need tech. You need tech in your business. But if you go too far too fast with tech, with our market, you'll lose people. And if you don't bring people on the journey, and also, you know, personally, just not spending enough time with clients and not getting the feedback firsthand. So there's an art to sort of, you know, getting ahead of the tech, getting the tech up and running. And then staying in touch with people, keeping the business still personable, and then still keeping the business where I can get feedback direct from clients personally. And so it's that mixture there where we've made some mistakes over the period of time.
always looks good from the outside, Tim, but I'm sure there was some moments on the inside.
There's been, yeah, of course, there's hairy moments and there's some moments that you choose to forget, but there's a lot of good moments as well.
What would be the proudest achievement that you've, over that period of time developing Feed Central, what's the pinnacle for you personally? What was one of the highest?
Look, there's no doubt the launch of the local ag marketplace is a really, really substantial thing. Like it's new tech, it's open, it's transparent, it's really smart, and it's, you know, it's really groundbreaking. It allows the Feed Central quality assurance stuff to come over it. Standing up with the team, we had a big launch with the Toowoomba Chamber of Commerce in January, standing up with the team and popping the poppers and launching local ag is a really, really proud achievement for me. Just standing alongside the team that you've worked with to get it there, that's always the, that's, you know, and the family's there and the team's there, and that's a really proud moment, yeah.
Well done. No, yeah. Great yeah. Achievement.
Yeah.
Have you had mentors along the way, Tim, that have got beside you? You were fairly innovative, really, in terms of the business model, but did you have some good help along the way, some wise heads?
I've always adopted the philosophy that, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. I think it's one of those famous Confucius sayings. I'm not sure. So I haven't really had that permanent. I haven't had anyone that's been there sort of the whole time. But there's a whole heap of people that I can call when there's a problem. So, you know, it's almost like a really close network of people around that you can call for a specific when something's going on, specific advice, I suppose. So, you know, there's probably been, you know, someone like Sir Matt Jurak, who's he's now involved in the Pure business, the Pure Grain business, but he's extensively involved in Starman Farms. You know, the likes of Matt's been there all the way along, and you know when something, you know, I think Matt knows if he's going to get a phone call from me, it's probably fairly serious. Yeah. Better. And so there's been people like that that have been there a long time, you know, people like that crew that we hung around with at Whyalla, between Sinclair, Rob Lawrence, who's a really well-known nutritionalist in that feedlot space, and you've just got a whole heap of people around that you can ring to get a problem solved or to talk through a problem with. And, you know, there's been a lot of family members. Dad was very much the same when he was alive. Megan, my wife, fills a very big gap in that space as well. You know, maybe we're getting to a space where we need something more permanent than that. I'm not busting to jump into a board environment or anything like that, but I've sort of got, you know, that group of people around me that can, that do contribute in that way.
Interesting. That's very good. If you're talking to, we've got a lot of young members of Angus Australia, they're starting out in their cattle breeding journeys or involved in the industry there, what would be couple of pieces of gold nugget wisdom from Tim that you'd tell a young person starting out their business?
It's a network, isn't it? Like, it's that personal network, those people you went to college with and the people you work with and the conferences you go to. And and then it's that reputation, you know, and it's not about your business reputation, it's about your personal reputation, so that you those people, you might not see those people for years, like you and I, we might not have seen each other for years, but you know that, you know, he's a good fella, he's going to do the right thing by me.
Yes.
And so it's just that personal reputation of being a good, solid person that's going to do the right thing by me, and then just developing those networks. I really don't think that we ever thought, like when we were at Gatton, when we were at uni, did we ever really think that the mates we were hanging out with were actually going to stay with us for life?
It's a really interesting point, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know that we thought about it.
Didn't think about it at all. But often we can look across sideways and a lot of those people are really significant in the industry, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're wise heads now.
And so choosing who you hang out with, I suppose if you had to give the advice, you know, you're choosing who you hang out with because it's a lifelong, it's a lifelong thing. Choosing who you marry is bloody important, because that has a, you know, I think I did well in that area, and then keeping in touch, you know, and trying to do the, you know, like there's people that we're doing business with that we did business with 25 years ago, and when I first took the phone call, did I actually invest in that phone call to the extent that they've invested in me? You know, we're still doing business 25 years late. Did I answer that phone and gave them everything when I spoke to them? I don't know, you know, but like, so it's like being, if it's possible, being really present, because you don't know where that relationship's going to take you in the future. So,
interesting point there.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
You must have got a few wins there, Tim, I'd say.
Yeah, there's probably been a few losses as well, but, you know, there's a whole heap of people that you've done business with and, you know, like you're sort of, okay, yeah, you've got to really be mindful of that person. Hopefully they'll still be knocking around with you in 15, 20, 30, 40 years time. So it's a great part. There's money attached to that, and there's a good, you know, where there's good in agriculture, where there's a good relationship, money will fall out of it, but it's not about that, you know. It's about just having that relationship with those people for that period of time, you know, that saying, you see them go through their life challenges and that's all, that's special, you know. That's good.
And that leads into another question I did have for you is, would be, I like to ask this to people, and often when they come to work for Angus Australia, we're interviewing people for different things, talk about values, and you might have just given us one, but what's say two or three personal values that you try to live out in your business, Tim?
One of the big ones for us is the team, family, friends. Team, family, friends is a huge part of, you know, Feed Central Local Ag, and it's all about obviously the team, the staff members that we work with, but then the family, friends is the team members, families. But, you know, so many clients become friends along the way. And so, you know, team, family, friends means different things to different people, and it's not supposed to be a prescription as to how you work in Feed Central, but team, family, friends is sort of a bit of a motto that we have, that's, you know, it needs to be about the people, it needs to be about the client, it needs to be about relationship, and you got to do the right, you got to try and do the right thing by people. And when the screws are down and somebody's doing it tough and they can't do a contract or whatever, you know, that's when it gets really meaty and juicy, that those values. But yeah, team, family, friends, mean you're going to try and look after people, you're going to try and look after your teammates, you're going to, like, the you know, our carriers that have been with us for a long time, our truckies, they're a big part of our team, you know, because it's just that team, family, friends thing. And those clients, you know, you end up knowing the kids, you ended up knowing that, you know, so it's all of that network, I suppose, and then trying to pull all that together. So that team, family, friends is a really big part of how we do things.
I like that. It resonates a bit. Often we hear Angus people talk about the Angus family.
Yes.
And I think it's very similar, and you can watch from the outside. There might be a stud operator with their bull stud, but around that there's this collection of relationships with commercial people and other producers they work with, and just like you said, they're transport operators there, and
agents, and everyone's got
a media order web, isn't it?
Relationships. Yeah, that's right.
Yep. No, I think that's excellent. If you look at how do you, as a person, as a business leader, keep learning? What do you do? Do you read? Do you conferences? You mentioned before other things. How do you keep abreast yourself?
Well, we go to a lot of conferences. Ability to sit there and concentrate during the conference is always a little bit difficult for me. Like, I do find it very very rewarding to go to the conference. I love, you know, you're meeting people and having a yarn, having a beer after the conference. That's always really good as well. I've just finished the Australian Rural Leadership Program, which is that program run by the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation. I suppose that's worked for me, because it's not sitting in the classroom, it's all experimental, and it's all outdoors and in the bush with other people. So I've done that sort of personal development stuff along the way, and the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation's program is a 15-month program, so it's pretty hands-on, and you know, try and put you into positions where it challenges you physically and challenges you mentally, and that's been particularly useful for me. Don't particularly love the classroom situation. I certainly didn't make every lecture back in the day, but you know, obviously it's part and parcel of it, and you got to do it. But I've really enjoyed that experimental stuff, and you know, more practically, would I prefer to be in a conference or would I prefer to be driving up a driveway? I'd probably prefer to drive up a driveway and have a yarn, have a cup of tea with somebody. And you learn so much from clients, you know, like there is so many good operators out there and they sort of think they're doing just what they've always done, but there is so much. You ask the right questions, you'll learn something from those people as well. So that's a pretty good part of it.
Yeah, great. Are you a reader, Tim, at all?
I have done a lot of reading in the past, but not at the moment. I've done a lot of the really simple Brian Tracy type business books and what I would call business parables. You know, they take 2 or 3 hours to read if you sat down them in one hit. I've just picked them up at the airport and buy them. And there's some amazing stuff there. Am I going to sit down and read a 500-page book about business? No. And, you know, on holidays you get to and read a good mystery or something like that, but not an avid reader. Read the newspaper and read the Country Life and so forth online, but not a real avid day-to-day reader.
No, that's a good answer. What's the next chapter for you in the business for Local Ag and Feed Central? It might be Local Ag, is it?
Well, we've done a lot of growth and we've done a lot of changes. So the next chapter is about, just making it all work. And so I think, the next year is about making it all work and pulling it all together. There'll probably need to be a couple of new team members next year. So we've done a lot of growth in the last 2 years, and so I don't want to say no more growth, but it's like let's just get what we've done.
Yeah, it's a consolidation.
Yeah, really, really working, because what we've done is really cool, and it's really important that we spend the time, bring the clients on the journey, and get a lot of that consolidated.
Okay, no, that's good. Any new trends that cattle producers need to be aware of in the fodder world? What should they be on the lookout for coming up?
I think that on the biosecurity front, I think it's going to get bigger and it's going to get better. Mm-hmm. I think the fodder industry needs to put in place mechanisms around weed control, and we're working on that. There's some very, very clean crops out there, but all fodder's put in a basket that it might have weeds, and there's some growers that you can... Some come so close to guaranteeing no weeds that it's not funny. The export fodder industry is set up around that as well. So I think the weed space, which is the biosecurity space, that's a big one for both the fodder industry and the cattle industry. I think we're very, very close to be able to put something in place that gives a lot of security around that. And also I think vetch hay is a bit of a winner. And it's getting a lot of traction, very high protein. It's a dry land crop, so it grows in, sort of a bit of a lucerne replacement, particularly in, maybe not in the feedlots, because lucerne does have a special spot with hospital pens and some smaller feedlots with inductions and so forth. But vetch has a great spot in a grazing situation for that high protein, high energy. Cattle love it. And if it drops a few vetch seeds, everyone loves it. You know, a bit of vetch mixed up in your pastures.
Doesn't hurt.
No one complains. So, and there's, from a production perspective, dry land grows really well in those marginal cropping regions, fixes nitrogen into the soil. Vetch is the one to watch.
Excellent.
It's growing and it's growing in acceptance from buyers. There's good feedback.
That's a good tip.
Yeah.
Tim, I've got a couple of questions left for you. You've travelled extensively, no doubt. You've probably, like myself, we're privileged sometimes in these positions to see lots of farms, lots of farmers, have great conversations. Can you think of a part of Australia or a producer or one of our characters in the cattle industry or the fodder industry that might stand out particularly to you?
Oh, look, I'm an absolute sucker for South Australia. The South Australian people are very, very welcoming. The hospitality is fantastic, and the food is incredible. You know, so yeah, you get into that Broadacre, South Australian area, just off the Barossa Valley, and you can stay in the Barossa overnight and visit hay growers.
Might be able to go and slide in a Barossa Shiraz.
And then duck down to the southeast and visit some good Angus growers. You know, Angus producers down in the southeast of South Australia. It's close to pretty well perfect for me, South Australia.
It is a beautiful part of the world there. Our South Aussie producers will be very glad to hear you say that, especially our South Australian director, Simone Bond. She'll be very pleased to hear that comment.
Not there's anything wrong with the New England or anywhere else, but South Australia is just pretty special for me.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. How do you switch off, Tim? So you've got a pretty stressful job. You have a lot of moving parts. Do you go camping? Do you go to the pub, watch the footy? What do you do?
Simple for me. Like, there's a lot of my mates are the same. Like, it's the country boys that had come off a farm and don't farm seriously. It comes out of the gut. Yeah. You know, like fruit trees, citrus trees, and you know, your kangaroo paws and your grevilleas and so forth in your garden. Like, I spend a fair bit of time in the garden, I suppose. So
that's
just by myself, and really rewarding just to make your house look good and have that. So, I mean, it's pretty simple. I mean, we love it when the Brisbane Lions make the grand final. This podcast will probably be aired by the time. We don't know who's going to win the grand final, but if the Brisbane Lions was to win the grand final, that would be even extra better than a nice grevillea growing in the garden. But love sitting around watching the Lions final on the weekend, that's for sure. So that's great. That was pretty good.
I forgot you're from down the south.
That's right.
Rugby tips. Yes. No, yeah. that's fair. It's a beef industry podcast. What would be your best ever beef eating experience that you've had that you can recall?
Oh, look, it's without doubt, as a kid, we had some Angus steers on a gistman. We had a bit of rain that no one else seemed to have, and we had a decent oat crop, and we had some Angus steers on a gistman from somewhere, I don't know where, and this one steer, like, Angus are known for a great demeanour and so forth, but this one Angus steer, he did not want to stay on the oats paddock. He wanted to get in next door, where I don't know why, there wasn't anything particularly special there. And my brother was a bit tired of getting him back in, so he got the rifle out and shot him. Oh. And you know, this is back, you know, 35 years ago now. I was only pretty young. And then he realised, oh, hell, like, I'm going to get in trouble for this. So he decided he'd better burn him. Oh. So he put him on a big pile of sticks out in the paddock, big logs. And then anyway, you know, him and I are sort of, I'm guilty by association, he's guilty by doing it. And so the next day we thought we should go back and make sure that the animals burnt up. So we go back and check that this animal, and we just touched the leg of this little steer, and in the fire, and it just melts off, and there's this beautiful slow cooked Angus rump there.
Amazing.
And we just grabbed it out of the fire and just ate it, and it was just absolutely delicious.
That's a cracking
story. So,
I can't believe that.
Yeah, yeah. So, it was long cooked, 24 hours out in the open. It was just the best bit of beef I've ever had.
So, I didn't expect that. I thought maybe Korean barbecue from your earlier.
Oh, I've had Korean barbecue. I've eaten a lot of places. Fantastic. But that was the very best piece.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Tim, as we draw to a close, what would you, anything you'd like to say to our Angus producers around that we might have missed? Any words of wisdom?
I just what the Angus breed is doing as a whole is just, you know, next level. If you can continue what you've done in the last 10 or 15 years and the next 10 or 15 years, it's pretty incredible. I think one of the statistics from your conference in Brisbane was that Angus beef is bigger than Pepsi or Coca-Cola, there was some amazing statistic, and there was still this all this branding opportunity around Angus beef. And yeah, it's just incredible. From a consumer, me personally, I think that the the Wagyu thing is going to come and go a bit. Like, it seems like, you know, you go and you have Wagyu and it's very rich and it's very tasty, but I don't know, you don't just have that desire to go back and back and back to eat Wagyu, like, but you go back and back and back and you want a good steak. And if it's at a pub and it's branded Angus, then that's what I'm going to go for. And so it's just, from an outsider's perspective, keep batting away, keep differentiating, keep promoting your product as a premium product, making it stand out. And over a period of time, the rewards pay off, and it's fantastic to see. And you grade the industry partnerships, you're really working hard to get industry partnerships and so forth going. So, that's great for people like us, because we do like to be associated with progressive organisations, but also, it's great for members and membership as well to have those sort of people around the association. But fundamentally, product differentiation into a big market is going to pay off over a period of time.
Oh, look, thanks, Tim. Thanks for your kind words there. Angus producers will be glad to hear some of those kind words. And we appreciate your insights, your going under the hood with your business. We wish you all the success with Local Ag going forward. I'm sure that if it's anything like what you've achieved in Feed Central in your business career, it'll be a great success. So thanks for being on the podcast today.
Appreciate it very much, Scott. It's a great opportunity to be able to share our story with your members, and huge thanks to the many Angus Australia members that have been big supporters of Feed Central over a very long period of time, and we appreciate that support very, very, very much.
I'd say if we overlaid our databases, there'd be a lot of common names on
there'd be a lot of common names in there, I assure you. Yes.
All right, thanks very much, Tim.
Yep, thanks, Scott. Thanks, team.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.